I shook my head and returned to my seat. Montrose took center stage.
Our would-be prosecutor delights in recklessly tainting the reputation of my client, said Bill Montrose, glancing my way. I had the sense that he was just warming to his task. Till now, we haven't retaliated by drawing attention to the sad details of his late brother's life. It seemed inappropriate and I had hoped unnecessary. Now, said Montrose, as if he'd spent the night wrestling with his oversized conscience, we have no choice. If, in fact, Peter Mullen's death wasn't an accident, which is doubtful, there are people far more likely to have done him harm than Barry Neubauer. When Peter Mullen died at the end of last May, said Montrose, clearing his throat, the world did not lose its next Mother Teresa. It lost a high school dropout who, at the age of 14, had already been arrested for drugs possession. You should also know that despite having never held a regular job in his life, Peter Mullen had almost $200,000 in his bank account at the time of his death. 2 months earlier, he paid for a $19,000 motorcycle with an envelope of $1,000 bills.
How did they know that? Had someone been following me?
Unlike our prosecutor, I'm not irresponsible enough to stand up here and claim that Peter Mullen was a drug dealer. I don't have enough evidence to say that. But based on his background, bank account and lifestyle, and no other way to explain his wealth, it does beg the question, doesn't it? And if Peter Mullen made his living selling drugs, he would have attracted violent rivals. That's the way the drug world works, even in the Hamptons.
Hearing these phony charges dragged out yet again pushed me out of my seat.
No one, I said, claims my brother is a candidate for sainthood, but he wasn't a drug dealer. Everyone in this room knows it. Not only that, they know exactly how $200,000 found its way into his bank account, because it was their money. Your Honor, protested Montrose, the prosecutor has no right to this kind of grandstanding, even if he is your grandson.
Macklin sat there and nodded.
If the prosecutor has something to share with the court, he said, he should cut the crap and do so. He should also be advised that any further unprofessional behavior will not be tolerated in this courtroom. This is supposed to be a fair trial, and damn it, that's what it's going to be.
Chapter 100. After months of obsessing about this trial, studying for it, investigating and gathering evidence, the moment of truth was here. I'd wanted justice for Peter, and maybe I could have it. If I was good enough. If I could keep my temper and indignation in check. If I could actually beat Bill Montrose just this one time, fair and square.
I have some crucial evidence to present to the court, I said. But first I want to clear up something regarding my brother Peter's drug arrest. It happened in Vermont 8 years ago. I was a 19-year-old college student, and Peter, who was 14, was visiting me. One night, a local policeman pulled us over for a broken taillight. He came up with an excuse to search the car and found a joint under the driver's seat. That's what happened. Knowing that I had just applied to law school, though, I wouldn't actually go to Columbia for a few more years, Peter insisted that the joint was his. It wasn't. It belonged to a friend of mine. I'm telling you this to set the record straight and to illustrate that while Peter was no saint, he was as good a brother as anyone could hope to have. Nothing I'm about to show you changes that. Now, if you can just adjust the lights, I continued. The people have a couple of exhibits we would like to share. Marcy scrambled up a small stepladder and refocused a pair of 1,500-watt spots until they flooded a 12-foot section of the side wall. Close to the center of the lighted area, I taped a large, colorful illustration. It showed a rosy-cheeked toddler, snug and warm in a reindeer festoon sweater.
The child was surrounded by cuddly stuffed toys.
This is the cover of last year's Christmas catalog for Bjorn Boontang Toys, whose company slogan is Made by Elves, and which is now owned by Barry Neubauer. I will read what the catalog copy says. Bjorn Boontang is the most profitable manufacturer of toys and furniture in the world. The three stuffed lionesses on the cover are the incredibly popular Snea, Seda, and Meta, sold by the tens of thousands to parents all over the world. Inside this catalog are 200 pages of children's toys, clothing, and furniture. The people will offer this picture as Exhibit B, I said. Then I looked around the room like a guerrilla fighter, in the eerily serene seconds before firing off his first missile. The people will now offer Exhibit C. Chapter 101. Exhibit C, I have to warn you, is not nearly as wholesome as the Bjorn Boontang Christmas catalog, I said. In fact, if you're watching with your children now, you should have them leave the room. I walked slowly back to my table and picked up the portfolio-sized envelope. As I did so, I peered at Barry Neubauer, holding his glance until I could see the first shadow of panic in his narrowing eyes. The images I'm about to put on this wall aren't warm and fuzzy. They're hot and cruel and in razor-sharp focus. If they celebrate anything, it's definitely not children or family.
Objection! Shouted Montrose. I vehemently object to this. Let the evidence speak for itself, said Macklin. Go on, Jack.
My heart was banging as violently as if I was fighting for my life, but I spoke with preternatural calm. Your Honor, I said, the people call Miss Pauline Grabowski. Pauline walked briskly to the witness chair. I could tell that she was eager to play her part, even if it meant implicating herself. Miss Grabowski, I began, how are you employed? Up until recently, I was a private investigator employed at Mr. Montrose's law firm. How long were you employed there? 10 years, until I quit. How were you viewed by the firm? I received 5 promotions during my 10 years. I was given performance bonuses each year that exceeded the target bonus by at least 100%. Mr. Montrose himself told me that I was the best investigator that he had worked with in his 20 years of practice. I couldn't help but smile as Montrose squirmed in his seat. Now, Miss Grabowski, what, if any, role have you played in the investigation of this case? Well, I've done the usual background checks, talked to potential witnesses, collected documents. Directing your attention to Tuesday, the 3rd of May, did you meet with counsel at the Memory Motel? Yes, I did. What, if anything, did you find there? I found Sammy Giamalva's private collection of photographs. I examined several dozen black and white prints. Now it was about to begin. I moved in slow motion, extricating the photographs inch by inch. Miss Grabowski, are these the photographs? Yes. Are they in the same condition today as the day you first saw them? Yes. Your Honor, the people offer People's Exhibit C, 13 8x10 black and white print photographs. Montrose screamed.
Objection!
Macklin waved him off.
Overruled. This is relevant evidence that has been authenticated by a qualified witness. I'll allow it.
I held the first photograph with its back to the room and carefully examined it. It still made me sick. Then I walked to the wall and taped the photograph beside the cover of the Bjorn Boontang Toys Christmas catalog. Only when I was satisfied that it was securely attached to the wall and not the slightest bit askew did I step aside. I let Molly zoom in and lock off in tight focus. The first thing that hit anyone who viewed the photograph was the lurid intensity of the lighting. Even in this well-lit room, it burned like neon in the night. It was the kind of light that is pumped into operating rooms and morgues
It froze every vein and follicle and blemish in a nightmarish hyperreality. Matching the harsh intensity of the lighting were the crazed expressions of the two men and one woman, and the heat of the action itself. They were crowded together at the center of the print, as if the woman was on fire and the men were huddling around her for warmth. Only after adjusting to the glare would anyone notice that the woman between the two men was Stella Fitzharding. The man sodomizing her was Barry Neubauer, and the man on his back beneath her was my brother. Chapter 102. The black and white photograph jolted the room like a powerful concussive blast that leaves those in the vicinity damaged but unbloodied. It was Neubauer who broke the silence.
"God damn bastard," he shouted.
Montrose bellowed,
"Objection! Objection! Objection!"
As if his client's cry had tripped a mechanical alarm in his throat, their ruckus set off Macklin. He was mad and it showed.
"I'll gag the whole room if you don't pipe down. This is evidence and it's certainly relevant. I'll allow it."
Only when quiet had been restored did I return to the painstaking task of hanging more photos. Reminding myself to take my time to build the boat, I spent the next 5 minutes taping up pictures of Peter and various partners. Altogether, I put up 13, a pornographer's dirty dozen, and just about the saddest family album I've ever seen. Although there were occasional cameos by unrecognizable guests, the core troupe remained constant. Barry and Peter, Stella and Tom, the Neubauer's best friends. We definitely had the right people in the room. They'd been doing my brother since he was a kid. There's no denying the disconcerting power of hardcore pornography. After each photograph was secured to the wall, Molly zoomed in for a close-up. She held for a full 10 seconds.
"Turn off the camera," screamed Neubauer. "Stop it now!"
"Could the prosecutor and I approach the bench?" asked Bill Montrose after speaking to Neubauer.
When Mac waved us forward, Montrose said,
"Mr. Neubauer has a proposal he believes could end these proceedings. He's asked me to pass it on."
"The people aren't interested," I said flatly.
"What is it?" asked Macklin. "My client insists on presenting it himself, in private."
"There is nothing of value he can offer this court," I told Macklin. "Let's move on." Montrose reiterated his request to Macklin.
"All he wants is 90 seconds, Your Honor. Surely you can spare us that, in the interest of fairness or whatever the hell this is supposed to represent."
"This court is recessed for 2 minutes, announced Macklin. "Give the networks a chance to sell some beer."
He motioned for Fenton, then led all four of us into a library equipped with a running track and a ladder to get to the high shelves. Of course, there were no books. Being in a confined space with Neubauer, even with his hands cuffed, was unsettling. He was close to a rage of state. He wasn't used to not getting his way. His eyes were dilated and his nostrils flared. He gave off a feral, vinegary odor that was hard to take.
$10 million, said Neubauer as soon as the door shut behind him. "And none of us will cooperate in any criminal proceeding against you, your grandfather or your friends."
"That's your proposal, Mr. Neubauer?" asked Macklin.
$10 million, he repeated, "in cash, deposited into an account in your name in Grand Cayman in the Bahamas. Plus, no one in your group spends any time in jail. You have my word on it. Now, would somebody take off these cuffs? I want to get out of here. You got what you want. You won."
"We aren't interested in your money," I said flatly. Neubauer flicked his head at me dismissively.
"A couple of years ago," he said, "some of my guests got a little carried away. A hooker fell off my yacht. It cost me $500,000. Now another whore has died, and I want to settle my account again. I'm a man who pays his debts."
"No, Barry,
You're a murdering scumbag. Frank Volpe was good enough to confirm that last night. You can't buy your way out of this, asshole.
I realized I had gone over the edge. Neubauer's face twisted into the same pre-ejaculatory grimace recorded in some of the pictures. Then he spoke in a freaky whisper.
I liked fucking your brother, Jack. Peter was one of my all-time favorite pieces of ass, particularly when he was 15. Okay, Mullen?
I was leaning on the ladder, and Neubauer was straddling the metal track in the floor less than 2 feet away. The track led straight to his groin. All I had to do was grab the ladder and push hard, but I took control of myself. I wasn't going to let him return to the courtroom looking beaten up or abused.
I already know what you did to my brother, I said finally. That's why we're here. And it's going to cost you a lot more than money, Barry.
Let's get back to work, said Mac. It's not polite to keep 100 million people waiting. And if nothing else, we Mullins have our manners.
Chapter 103. Stella Fitzharding didn't fit the profile of a third wife of a New York Palm Beach billionaire. She was neither young, nor blonde, nor augmented. She was a former professor of Romance languages at the small Midwestern college to which her husband had given $100 million to get his name on the library. If she was embarrassed by her appearance in the graphic display on the wall, she didn't show it. The first time she had screwed my brother, he was 15 years old. Mrs. Fitzharding, I said, once she'd been sworn in. I have the feeling you've seen these photographs before. Is that true? Stella Fitzharding frowned, but nodded.
Peter had been using them to blackmail us for 2 years, she said.
How much did you pay him? I asked.
$5,000 a month, $7,500, I forget exactly, but I remember it was the same amount we pay our gardener.
She seemed bored by my questions. Bear with me, Stella. It'll perk up soon. Did you complain to Barry Neubauer?
We might have, except we found the whole experience of getting blackmailed so deliciously theatrical and, I don't know, noir. As soon as the pictures got dropped at our back door, we'd grab them and rush into the den where we'd pore over them the way other folk look at themselves smiling in front of Old Faithful. It was a game we played. Your brother knew that, Jack. It was a game for him, too.
I wanted to go after her, but I held everything inside. Who did you make the payments to? I asked. She pointed to the witness table.
Detective Frank Volpe was the messenger boy.
Volpe sat there very calmly. Then he gave Stella the finger.
So you paid the monthly fee to Detective Volpe?
Yes. But when the merger of Mayflower Enterprises and Bjorn Boontang Toys was announced, Peter suddenly realized how damaging the pictures could be. Instead of a few thousand, he wanted millions.
So what did you think when my brother's body washed up on the beach?
That he had played a dangerous game and lost, said Stella Fitzharding. Just like you are, and just like you will.
Chapter 104.
I called Detective Frank Volpe.
Volpe didn't move. I wasn't surprised. In fact, I'd expected this to happen with more of the witnesses.
I can question you from here, Detective, if you would prefer.
I'm still not going to answer your question, Jack.
Well, let me try just one.
Suit yourself.
Do you remember the talk we had last night, Detective? I asked.
Volpe sat there impassively.
Let me refresh your memory, Detective. I'm referring to the conversation in which you said that Barry Neubauer's goons murdered my brother on the beach a year ago.
Objection!
Yelled Montrose.
Sustained! Yelled Mac. Mrs. Stevenson, please delete the last two statements from the record.
I apologize, Your Honor, I said. The people have no further questions.
Nice work, Jack, said Volpe from his seat.
Chapter 105. We broke for lunch and returned promptly after 45 minutes. I couldn't eat. mostly because I was afraid I wouldn't be able to keep anything down. The witness I was about to call represented the kind of risk any really good trial lawyer is cautioned not to take. I felt I had no choice. It was time to find out if I was a good judge of human nature, and also if I was any kind of lawyer. I took a deep breath. "Campion Neubauer," I said. A hush fell over the room. Campion slowly got up and walked forward. She looked back at the other witnesses as if expecting one of them to throw her a lifeline. Bill Montrose immediately rose from his seat.
"Absolutely not. Mrs. Neubauer is currently undergoing treatment for chronic depression. She's been unable to take her medication since this ordeal began."
I looked at Campion, who had already sat down in the witness chair. "How are you feeling?" I asked her. "You okay with this?" She nodded. "I'm fine, Jack. Actually, I want to say something."
"Not that it means anything to you,"
shouted Neubauer from his seat.
"But the law prohibits forcing a wife to testify against her husband."
"The so-called spousal privilege," responded Macklin, "can be asserted by either spouse for their own protection. But the privilege only protects statements made by one spouse to another, not the underlying facts. You may testify, Mrs. Neubauer."
A thin smile broke across Campion's lips. I had known her for a long time and had seen her change from a beautiful, free-spirited woman to an extremely bitter one. That was part of the reason I was taking this chance with her now. "Not to worry, darling," she said to her husband. "No one's forcing me to testify against you. I'm here on my own free will." After Fenton swore Campion in, I asked if she would come with me to examine a few of the photographs on the wall. She did as I asked. I pointed to a woman apparently reaching climax in the third picture in the row. "Who is that?" I asked. "Stella Fitzharding. She's a freak." "And this younger woman on her knees?" "Trisha Powell. The young businesswoman doing so well in special events at my husband's company. And poured between the two of them, my brother Peter, who was certainly no saint." Campion shook her head. "No, but he never hurt anybody. And everyone did love Peter." "That's comforting," I said. I walked her down the line of photos. I pointed. "Peter, again," Campion said. "How old would you say Peter was when this picture was shot?" "I don't know, maybe 15? "No older than that?" I asked. "No, I don't think so. Jack, you have to believe this. I had no idea this was happening in my house. Not at first, anyway. I'm sorry. I apologize to you and your family."
"I'm sorry too, Campion."
We proceeded down the row.
In each of the next half dozen shots, spanning 5 years, my brother, who in the earliest pictures is no more than 15, is being mounted by a much older man.
"That would be my husband, Barry Neubauer," she said, and pointed to the man grabbing the arms of an old beach chair as tightly as he held Peter in the photos. We skipped several shots, then we stopped together in front of the last photograph in the series. In it, Peter and Barry were joined by a third middle-aged man wearing a studded dog collar, hooked to an industrial-strength leash.
"The man on all fours," I said. "I'm almost positive I've seen him before."
"Undoubtedly," said Campion.
"He's Robert Crassweller Jr., the Attorney General of the United States."
Chapter 106. I escorted Campion back to the witness chair. Suddenly she looked younger and more relaxed. She'd even stopped glancing over at Barry for approval or disapproval or whatever it was she got from him. "You still okay?" I asked.
"I'm fine. Let's keep going."
I gestured toward the wall of photographs. "Other than the faces and bodies, Campion, is there anything else you recognize in the pictures?"
"The rooms. The pictures were all shot at our house, the house I grew up in, the beach house my family has owned for nearly 100 years," Different rooms or the same one? I asked.
Mostly different.
One thing I can't quite figure out, I said, is where the photographer hid.
It depends on the shot, but there are any number of places, lots of nooks and crannies. It's a huge old house.
But how would the photographer know where to hide and be able to get himself there again and again without being detected? There was a crash behind me, and when I twisted to face it, Neubauer, having destroyed the table with his full stretch lunge, was crawling across the floor toward his wife. As Fenton and Hank pounced on him, a black tomahawk flew across the room, leaving a nasty black mark on the wall, 6 inches from Campion's head. It was Stella Fitzharding's left shoe. Your husband and friend seem quite certain you were the one helping the blackmailers, Mrs. Neubauer, I said. Unscathed by either attack, Campion sat on the stand as calmly as when she arrived.
I was, she said.
You were blackmailing your own husband, Mrs. Neubauer? I asked. But as controlling partner of Mayflower Enterprises, you had more to lose than he did.
I guess we would have to agree, Jack, but there are some things more important than money. At first I merely wanted to document it, Campion explained. Have a record of what was going on in a house that had been in my family for a century. But then I couldn't resist the thought of watching my husband squirm.
Peter didn't know about the blackmailing, did he?
He never would have gone along with it. He didn't hate Barry enough. Peter didn't hate anyone except himself. That was his loveliest flaw.
Wouldn't it have been easier to simply divorce your husband?
Easier, perhaps, but definitely not safer. As you've noticed by now, when Barry gets upset, people start washing up on shore. I covered my mouth with a hand and I took in a breath. Then I asked my next question, a big one.
Isn't that why you needed pictures even more incriminating than the ones up on the wall, Campion?
Her back stiffened.
I'm not sure I follow, she said, nervously fingering the black crystal amulet on her necklace.
I moved in closer to her. I think you do. It's one thing catching Barry having illicit sex with young boys and girls, but if, for example, you had pictures of him committing murder, isn't that why you set up Peter?
I didn't know Barry was going to kill Peter that night. How could I? Of course you did. You just told us. When Barry gets upset, people start washing up on shore. In fact, you sent Sammy to cover the murder. But there are no pictures, she pleaded. I don't have any pictures.
I held up an envelope.
But I do, Campion. I have the pictures right here.
Chapter 107.
All of the courtroom techniques I'd tried so hard to master through the winter and spring deserted me in a frantic, anxious rush. I quickly opened the envelope. Instead of milking the moment for what it was worth, my heart was pumping. All my senses were razor sharp. I held several photographs from the envelope in my fist. I rifled through them, then slapped them up on the wall with the others. They were probably the last 7 shots Sammy had ever taken, and in a terrible way they were his masterpieces. Each was printed horizontally on 19 by 22 inch paper and was as black and murky as Sammy's pornography was bright. Taped to the wall in a dark, jagged row, they looked less like photographs than expressionist paintings, swirling violently with rage and fear and death. Like so much of the pornography, the action was 3-on-1, but the hurt was now replaced by fury, the pelvic thrusts by wailing fists and feet. There, I could see the blurred face of Neubauer's platinum Cartier watch as he swung a blackjack at Peter's neck. And there, while 2 other burly shapes pinned back Peter's arms, I caught the silver streaks of the buckle on Neubauer's loafer as he kicked in Peter's ribs. There was a face half hidden in the shadows, but I could tell it was Frank Volpe's. He'd lied about being there and about Neubauer's part in it, but of course, why wouldn't he lie? Everyone else had. The last picture was the most hellish. I slapped it up on the wall and heard Molly's lens zoom in. I knew it would be engraved on my retina forever. At the instant this particular picture was taken,
There must have been a break in the cloud cover, as Peter lay broken at the feet of his murderers. His face was momentarily illuminated. It was like a candle-lit face in a Caravaggio, the face of a young man who knew he was down to his last few seconds and that no one was going to save him. The horror in his eyes was too much, and even though I'd seen the photograph before, I had to look away.
"Is there any end to this shameless grandstanding?" screamed Montrose. "In all of these pictures, you can only see a single face, and that's the victim's."
"The prosecutor will approach the bench," snapped Macklin. "Right now."
When I got there, he was as angry as I'd ever seen him.
"Montrose is right. These pictures are useless, and you know it. What the hell are you doing, Jack? Do you have a point to make?"
"Fuck Montrose and Neubauer, and fuck you!"
I spat out the words. Then I started to cry. I just lost it.
"I don't care whether these pictures have value as evidence to convict. They show Peter getting beaten to death on a beach by Neubauer and his goons, one of whom is Volpe. If I have to see it in my head for the rest of my life, then so do they. Peter didn't kill himself, he didn't drown, he was murdered, Mac. That's what it shows."
Macklin reached up and grabbed my wet face with both huge hands. He squeezed it hard, as if it were a bleeding wound he was trying to staunch.
"Jack, listen to me," he said with a heartbreaking smile. "You're doing a fine job. Better than that. Don't let it get away from you now, son. Do you have anything to finish off these bastards? Please, say yes, Jack."
Chapter 108. Don't let it get away from you now. When Peter and I were kids, our father told us a story about a huge rat that got into his and my mother's apartment in Hell's Kitchen. It was a freezing December morning. He had my mother, who was pregnant with me, sit in a coffee shop across the street. Then my father borrowed a shovel from the super and walked back up the 5 flights to face the rat. He found it in the living room at the end of the railroad flat, scurrying along the wall, trying to nose a way out. It was the size of a small cat, at least 10 pounds, with a shiny orange-brown pelt. Brandishing the shovel, my father backed it into a corner. The rat tried to get past, making feints left and right, but when he saw it was no use, he bared his teeth and waited. When my father cocked the shovel over his right shoulder like a Louisville slugger, the rat leapt at him. With a desperate swing, my father knocked it out of the air like a furry, gray-tailed softball. The rat bounced off the wall hard enough to knock over half the books on the shelves. My father barely had time to re-cock the shovel before the rat was flying back at him. Again, the shovel caught it flush. Again, the rat crashed into the wall. My father knocked it out of the air 2 more times before he could kill it. When I called Barry Neubauer to the stand, he looked at me like that rat must have looked up at my father that winter morning. Without taking his beady eyes off me, he twitched and he seethed. His long fingers were white where they clasped the arm of his chair. And he didn't budge. I was starting to breathe a little hard.
"You want me to sit on your stage?" he hissed. "You're going to have to drag me up there. But that wouldn't look good on television, would it, Golden Boy?" "We'd be delighted to drag you up here," said Macklin, stepping down off his platform. "Hell, I'll do it myself."
After making certain his arms and legs were securely tethered to the chair, Mac and I got on either side of him. We hoisted him into the air. As soon as his feet left the ground, he struggled against his restraints, worse than the mudman had in his dying moments. By the time we plopped him on the stand, his face and hair were covered with sweat. Behind his expensive wire-rim glasses, his pupils had shrunk to pinpoints.
"What do you have to show us now, counselor?"
he asked in an angry, grating whine that set my teeth on edge. It was the same demeaning tone he used with employees at his house.
More dirty pictures? Proving what? That photographic images can be manipulated by computer? Come on, Jack, you must have something better than that.
Neubauer's last taunt was barely out of his lips when there was a knock at the door at the back of the room. Actually, I do have something else to show you. In fact, here it comes now. Chapter 109. Nervously looking at her feet, the way anyone might if they found themselves walking through a lengthy room with half of America watching, Pauline slowly made her way to the front. I couldn't help feeling proud of her. She had stuck with this all the way to the end. When she got to my side, she slipped me a piece of paper. I read it with my heart in my throat. It said, East Hampton, L.A., Manhattan, 1996. Then, because she felt like it, I guess, she kissed me softly on the cheek and took a seat beside Marcy. There is one thing you could clear up for me, I said to Neubauer, gesturing toward the pictures on the wall. Did anyone ever ask you to use a condom? His thin slits of eyes narrowed even more.
Is this where you turn this whole thing into a public service announcement? I told them I had nothing to worry about. I have myself tested all the time.
I see. So you lied to these people. Neubauer's eyes grew even darker, and he twisted his neck at me.
What are you talking about?
I'm talking about not telling the truth. It's called lying. You lied to these people. Your wife, Tricia Powell. The Fitzhardings. My brother.
You're crazy. Anyone can see that. This is absurd. You're a madman.
Remember those blood samples we took when you arrived? We had yours tested for HIV.
What are you talking about?
Neubauer bellowed. You're positive, Mr. Neubauer. We ran it through 3 times. Your Honor, the people offer this lab report as People's Exhibit D.
You had no right,
he screeched, rocking his chair so violently that it nearly tipped off the platform. What's the difference whether we had the right? If you had yourself tested all the time, we just saved you the trouble.
It's not a crime to be sick,
Neubauer said. No, but it is a crime to knowingly expose your partners to HIV.
I didn't know I was HIV positive until this minute,
Neubauer snarled. I guess that might have been possible if it weren't for the AZT we found in your blood. Then we got your old pharmacy records. The people offer these records as People's Exhibit E. We had no right to do that either, but you killed my brother, so we did it anyway. We found you've had prescriptions for AZT in East Hampton, Los Angeles, and Manhattan. Since 1996. Neubauer's whole body was shaking. He didn't want to hear any more. Montrose was on his feet shouting objections, which Mac overruled. The Fitzhardings and Tricia Powell were screaming at Neubauer. So was Frank Volpe, who had to be restrained by Hank and Fenton.
Order!
Shouted Mac from his chair.
I mean it.
Would it surprise you to learn that in the last 2 weeks, I continued, we've tracked down 12 people from the photographs on this wall and in this envelope. Not including my brother, who you also infected, 7 have since tested positive. Marcy wheeled the camera around behind Neubauer. As I spoke to him, I was virtually looking into the lens. Your Honor, the people now offer 7 sworn affidavits by 7 individuals who, based on the timing of the results, all believe they were infected by Barry Neubauer. More important, they state in their affidavits that Neubauer lied to them about his HIV status.
This is all a lie,
Neubauer continued to scream at me. He was shaking uncontrollably in his chair.
Make him stop these lies about me, Bill.
I slowly walked toward Barry Neubauer. He'd always been so smug and controlled. He didn't believe anyone could touch him. He was smart. He was rich. He was the CEO of a major corporation. He owned people. Only now, his dark eyes looked as doomed as Peter's had on the beach. In New York State, knowingly exposing someone to HIV is first-degree assault. It's punishable by up to 12 years in prison. That's on each count. 12 times 12 works out to 144 years in prison. I could live with that. I bent down close to the bastard's face. My brother was flawed. Who isn't? But he was basically a good person, a good brother. Peter never hurt anybody. You killed him. I can't prove it, but I got you anyway, you bastard. How about that?
I straightened up and addressed Molly's lens for the last time. The People versus Barry Neubauer, I said. Rest their case. We're out of here.
Chapter 110. It was almost 5 in the afternoon when Fenton and Hank led our guests out the front door and released them.
Go forth and multiply, Fenton said.
For a while, we all stood blinking in the golden East End light, not knowing quite what to do next. The Fitzhardings, Campion, and Tricia Powell drifted off to one end of the porch. They sat quietly together, their feet dangling over the side, their eyes staring vacantly at the unsotted lot. Frank Volpe found his own spot nearby.
Geez, Pauline said. They look like day laborers, waiting for a lift home. Maybe clothes do make the man, and woman. I need to rethink everything.
Bill Montrose sat alone on the stoop about 10 feet away from the others. Still tethered to the old beach chair, Barry Neubauer sat where Fenton and Hank had planted him after carrying him out of the house. His eyes barely moved. No one came over to talk to him, not even his lawyer. That's a nice image, Pauline said. Barry Neubauer, alone and broken. I'm gonna hang on to it for a rainy day. We outfitted Marcy, Fenton, and Hank with bathing suits, beach towels, and flip-flops. Then we sent them wandering off in separate directions like 3 more sun-addled vacationers. Since they had never appeared on camera, there was no one to verify their involvement except for the hostages. We hoped they'd be too distracted with their own problems to worry about them. Molly dragged her tripod to the driveway and looked for the best vantage point to shoot the big final scene. Pauline, Mac, and I sat down at the end of the porch away from our guests. We were blown away and as exhausted as they were. We leaned against one another more than the wall of the house. We soaked up some sun. Late afternoon rays always seemed the most precious, even at the beginning of the summer. But these even more so. They felt like, I don't know, affection.
I love you, Pauline, said Mac, breaking the silence.
Love you back, said Pauline, too tired to lift her head off my chest. I cleared my throat ostentatiously until Mac added,
Don't get maudlin, Jack. We're quite fond of you, too.
After a while, Mac got up with a groan and walked over to where Tricia Powell was sitting. He reached into her tote and pulled out a chrome Nokia. She was too tired to complain.
Don't worry, Trish, said Mac. It's local. Anyone have anything profound to say before the shit hits the fan?
He asked when he returned. Thanks, I said. I couldn't have done it without you. Couldn't have done a thing. I love you both.
Anyone want to add something we don't know? Replied Mac as he settled back down with us. Okay, then.
He tapped the phone's tiny rubber pads with his enormous splayed fingers, then smiled with exaggerated delight when it started ringing.
Damn thing actually works. This is Mac Mullen, he told whoever picked up at the police station. Me, my grandson, and his beautiful girl are sitting around with the Neubauers, the Fitzhardings, and some of our other favorite people on Earth. We were wondering if you wanted to stop by. We're at the Kleiner Hunt place. Oh, one other thing. No one's hurt, and no one's armed. There's no need to do anything silly. We'll go peacefully.
Then he snapped the little phone shut like a clam and hurled it off the porch into the sand.
They should ban those things.
Less than 5 minutes later, about 100 cops and federal agents roared up Montauk's main street in their various marked and unmarked cars amid wailing sirens that sounded like the end of the world. Because the Coast Guard helicopters got there just before them, we didn't hear a thing as they arrived to arrest us. Epilogue. Chapter 111. It is almost 5 months later. Pauline Macklin and I are sitting in the far corner of a bar near Foley Square. We're sipping muddy Guinnesses. Except for the bartender and a white cat, the place is empty. Most bars are at 11 in the morning, even in boomtown New York.
"May he rot in jail,"
says Macklin, dusting off his favorite toast since the start of the summer. For the record, it looks as if Barry Neubauer will. His first manslaughter trial just began, and there are 12 more lined up behind it like Mercedes and Audi station wagons at a Route 27 traffic light. And here's the best part. Because of the likelihood of Neubauer trying to flee the country, he's spending his nights and weekends on Rikers Island until the last verdict is in the books. The stock of Mayflower Enterprises has dropped to under $2. Barry Neubauer is ruined. As for the three of us, today will probably be our last day of Guinness sipping freedom for some time. Our lawyer, Joshua Epstein, the same guy representing Molly in Channel 70, refused to have a drink with us before we head over to court in another few minutes. He's already prepared us, though. He doesn't think our chances are good. Mac is utterly unfazed. Then again, he's 87. He says he wants to throw a Memorial Day party of his own to replace the gaping beach house hole in the Hamptons social calendar.
"I want to throw a real party,"
he says, wiping the foam off his lips.
"Something that will make those Puff Daddy shindigs that everyone gets so bent out of shape over seem like an afternoon tea."
"I feel you, Macklin," says Pauline. "I don't want to be a party pooper," I tell the two of them, "but it's time to go. We have a date in court."
"I prefer this bar," says Mac,
and grins like the madman he is. "Let's go face the music," I say. Chapter 112. As Pauline, Mac, and I approached the steps of the United States District Court in Foley Square, we were met by our nervous-looking attorney, Joshua Epstein, and a crush of reporters, their lights and microphones and cameras pushing against the blue and white police barricades.
"My clients have no comment,"
Josh waved off the press hordes, throwing a stern stare at Mac and me. Then he led us on a brisk ascent of the limestone steps into the column-lined entryway, through the metal detectors, and onto the elevator. We rode the elevator to the 23rd floor in silence. As the door slid open, Mac cleared his throat.
"In the words of that old Irishman, Benjamin Franklin, we must all hang together, or most assuredly, we will hang separately."
The courtroom of the Honorable James L. Blake looked not the least like our people's courtroom on the cliffs of Montauk. With 30-foot ceilings, chandeliers, polished mahogany paneling, and benches for the public, it could have been the old Whaler's Church in Sag Harbor. We took our seats at the defense table as Josh chatted in hushed tones with the assistant United States attorney assigned to our case. Dressed in a plain gray suit, white button-down shirt, and a red and blue silk rep tie, AUSA Arthur Marshall was reasonable yet stern, determined to exercise his prosecutorial discretion in accordance with the Department of Justice operating manual. 3 months earlier, Mac, Pauline, and I had all entered guilty pleas to a 2-count indictment charging us with conspiracy to kidnap and the actual kidnapping of Barry Neubauer, Campion Neubauer, William Montrose, Tom Fitzharding, Stella Fitzharding, Trisha Powell, and Frank Volpe. There had been no point in going through with a trial. We knew what we were doing. We knew why. At the time that we entered our guilty pleas, we were informed by Judge Blake of the price we would have to pay for the justice that we had gotten for Peter.
At the time of sentencing, you will face a custodial sentence of not less than 20 years.
Today was that day.
All rise, commanded the bailiff as the Honorable James L. Blake entered the courtroom.
The crowd in the courtroom pews rose as the elderly judge lumbered up the steps to the bench, his black robes dragging on the floor behind him. He looked almost as old as Mac, and just as thorny. He took his seat and glared out at the courtroom.
Be seated, he barked.
The United States versus Jack Mullen, Macklin Reed Mullen, and Pauline Grabowski, called out the bailiff. This case is on for sentencing.
Chapter 113.
Is the government prepared to proceed?
Asked the judge.
The government is ready, Your Honor, replied AUSA Marshall, rising to his feet.
The defense?
We are ready to proceed, said Josh, looking a bit green around the gills.
Well then, have a seat, gentlemen, said the judge. We're likely to be here for some time.
With that, Josh and Arthur Marshall exchanged a quick glance and sat down.
I have been deeply troubled by the actions of the defendants in this case, as I am in every criminal case, began Judge Blake. Not simply because of the nature of the crime, an abhorrent deprivation of liberty worked upon several individuals, but because of the backgrounds of the defendants. The younger Mr. Mullen is a recent graduate of one of our nation's foremost schools of law, where he had the benefit of exposure to preeminent legal scholars. Miss Grabowski has spent the past 10 years as a private investigator employed by one of this city's most well-established law firms. She has testified in this very courthouse innumerable times, worked with some of our finest practitioners. As for the senior Mr. Mullen, you came to this country seeking economic opportunity for yourself and your family. You spent the majority of your adulthood as a hard-working man of your community. True, you have suffered a tremendous loss with the tragic death of your grandson, but this cannot excuse your conduct.
When the judge took a moment to catch his breath, Max seized the opportunity to whisper an old Irish prayer. For the first time, Pauline looked scared. I took her hand and squeezed it. I love this woman. I couldn't begin to imagine being separated from her now.
As for the government, young Mr. Marshall here, the judge continued, nodding in the direction of the prosecutor, and his boss, United States Attorney Lily Grace Drucker, have, in their infinite compassion, recommended that I impose only the minimum sentence statutorily available to me, 20 years, in light of the defendant's lack of any prior criminal records. After much consideration, I'm afraid I decline to accept the government's generous recommendation. But before I can proceed to hand down the sentence of the court, I wish to comment upon the collateral consequences of the defendant's actions. As I'm sure all parties are aware, as a direct result of the defendant's investigative work and expertise at trial, Mr. Barry Neubauer, the main victim here, has been charged with 12 separate accounts of manslaughter and is on trial as I speak in the New York State Criminal Court. As U.S. Attorney Drucker has announced, the FBI is also currently investigating William Montrose Esquire in connection with the charges that he suborned perjury and intimidated a witness, Dr. Jane Davis, at the inquest into Peter Mullen's death, again as a direct result of the defendant's actions. Mr. and Mrs. Fitzharding have left this court's jurisdiction and have refused to assist this court in its pre-sentence investigation. Detective Frank Volpe has recently been arrested in connection with the homicide of Sammy Giamalva here in Manhattan. He is also a suspect in the murder of Peter Mullen. And Campion Neubauer has been indicted as an accessory in the murder of Peter Mullen.
The judge looked up from his bench, as if to survey the courtroom.
These are dark times for our system of criminal justice. Recent verdicts in so-called high-profile cases have led to the broadly held conclusion that there is justice in this country only for those whose wealth or celebrity can buy it for them. I have sat on this bench for the past 40 years, since President Truman saw fit to appoint me. In all those years, I have never been as distressed by the so-called administration of justice in this country as I am today. That said, here is my ruling.
There wasn't a sound anywhere in the court. Pauline's nails were cutting into my palm. Macklin had my other hand wrapped in his.
The court, said Judge Blake, on its own motion, chooses to invoke Federal Sentencing Guideline 5K1.1. This section for the ladies and gentlemen of the press allows the court to downwardly depart in sentencing those defendants whose cooperation with the government has led to the investigation or prosecution of another person or persons. Given the valuable assistance the defendants have provided, I am sure that I will hear no objection from the government on this motion,
asked the judge. He looked over at the prosecution table. None whatsoever, croaked AUSA Marshall, looking in his fresh-scrubbed youth like a boy who had just been spared a dreaded chore by a forgiving adult.
Good answer. Macklin Reed Mullen, Pauline Grabowski, Jack Mullen. The court sentences you each to time served and to 600 hours of community service to be performed in the Legal Aid Society Capital Defenders Unit. From now on, the only trials you will be involved in will be on behalf of indigent death row defendants. This court now stands adjourned.
As the judge pounded his gavel on the bench and rose to walk down the stairs, the spectator section exploded in applause, cheers, and high fives. Reporters crowded around us as Mac, Pauline, and I embraced in a bear hug. None of us said a word to the press.
Your brother is proud of you, Mac whispered in my ear.
As the three of us were leaving the courtroom, arm in arm, I thought of something, an old, sacred memory. When Peter was just a little kid, after our mother had died, he used to sneak into bed with me just about every night. I like hearing your heartbeat, Jack, he'd say. I'd liked hearing Peter's heart, too. I missed it.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.